The first cut. Hello, motion picture brains. Oh, this is so sad. It's going to be one of the last time I say this. Last times, because we're moving on now. We've got... Well, go ahead. You tell them.
We've got a new series.
No, but it's you.
We've got a new voice.
A new person.
It's not just in your mind. It's real.
Although...
It's coming from a girl.
A lot of you would like to think that... It's in my mind, and, or we paid.
It's okay to hear voices, just don't
woman,
answer them.
If there's a woman in the, alone in the room with me, I must have paid for it, right? Like, liberally.
Nice.
But this is Emily Buller.
Oh, hey.
And what's happening now is that we are moving, Craft Truck is moving forward, and as we move forward, we...
I'm starting to drive. Look out. I don't have my license,
hey.
And I'm nearsighted.
Hey, where are we going? Don't take a ride here. Don't do that. we've decided we're going to, instead of having a whole bunch of different podcasts, we're just going to have one podcast for Craft Truck. So while we started with Through the Lens and it was all cinematographers, great bunch of peeps, by the way. Love those lensers. They're awesome.
They have great eyes.
Good teeth most of the time. But we decided we want to move past that. And since we're running new series, including Meet Your Makers, and In the Cut, which is with editors, and Meet Your Makers is Emily's bag. You can tell them a bit about that, what that is. What is that?
Meet Your Makers. So it's the people behind the scenes of, you know, prosthetics and makeup and props and pretty much anything that's not people. So they're crafty people and they make stuff and you should meet them. So that's going to happen.
So because of that, we're just putting everything into one stream now. That sounded bad, didn't it? One stream. It's like
one flow.
Everything's going into one flowing, dripping
flowing stream.
Stream.
I'm thirsty.
It's getting bad.
I have to pee.
I have to go to the bathroom too. Anyway, we should actually edit right now to the sound of like, you know. Anyway. So basically, anybody can introduce. So Emily is going to introduce. This is for the new series. In the cut, when we got some like crazy sick picture editors in for this.
Yeah, they were amazing.
Awesome. And it was hosted by a wide variety of people, myself, yourself, Baron Vaughn. Jesse Eichmann actually hosted an episode. That was kind of scary.
Yeah, I couldn't watch that one.
No, you couldn't. You had to. You were scared of the teeth, right?
I'll watch it later when it's cut together properly. Editors can save any performance, as you will see.
So tell us about this episode of In the Cut.
I had the pleasure of sitting down with Dan Liebenthal, who's widely known as Jon Favreau's right-hand man. He edited such films as Iron Man, Elf, and Very Bad Things. And Cowboys and Aliens, which we talked about, actually, in the interview. It was pretty awesome. He's got a lot of, like... little secret information about these films that he shared with me. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah, and also we might also want to mention that he did the recent, probably at the time this is premiering, the new Thor movie.
Oh, right.
Which was for Alan Taylor, who's also an amazing director. So he's incredibly versatile, but where did you speak to him again?
When we were in L.A., he came into our production house, hung out with us. He had a really cool gadget that was in part of Tech Bites. So if you want to check out Tech Bites, he's also talking about his app in that. So he's pretty well-rounded. He's a lot going on, so he's a pretty cool dude. For this podcast, it's the unedited interview with Dan Liebenthal.
Your conversation.
In L.A., yeah. Our conversations.
Yeah.
All the tidbits. All the bits that couldn't fit.
Into the
video.
And if you want to see the video version of this, it's In the Cut, I think episodes 1 and 2.
At crafttruck.com.
At crafttruck.com. Emily, thank you very much.
You're welcome, sir.
I had to pay for that, too.
I live here. I live under Jeff's desk. I'm just here all the time.
Whoa.
He's pretending I stopped by.
Yeah. Okay. We'll call it there. We'll call it there. I'm going to go cool down.
Feed me.
I'll just teach you simple cuts to start with.
Over here, guys. You live in Canada. What are you gonna do?
So yeah, if you're up for that, then we can really have a bit that focuses on your on your project. Unless you want to just talk about it in this.
No, it's all right. I just wondered if because you were saying you Googled, because it's kind of all over, because I put out the first pro editing app for the iPad.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I was like, your name and then editor, so maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't put innovator, so maybe that's Google.
That's right.
Well,
yeah.
I don't think
genius.
Technique extraordinaire.
That's right.
Yeah.
Futurist.
Visionary of his time. All right, are we good? Okay, so I'm going to do the intro and all that.
Okay.
Afterwards. So, here we go. One film on your credit list that is one of my big favorites is Very Bad Things.
Well, you are a sick girl, aren't you?
Yes, I am. You know, you think it's going to be lighthearted, and it gets darker and darker and darker, and it's so amusing and amazing.
Yeah, it's...
Was that fun?
Well, it was fun. It was Peter Berg's first film, and he would go, I don't know what I'm doing, I'm a rookie. And then we'd just kind of say, well, here's what we're doing. But yeah. What was interesting about it is I always thought that that movie was kind of about the sort of, I don't know, middle-class nightmare of making one mistake and your entire life unraveling. So I could really picture myself in that situation. And then I was having weird dreams while we were making it. I was like, wait a minute, I killed somebody, didn't I? And I buried them in some forest. And I was like, is this real? Do I have a suppressed memory? No, it was just working on this thing, you know, 14 hours a day. It was getting into my head.
Oh, yeah. Wow. So you're like just channeling Jeremy Piven's crazy mindset at the time.
Yeah.
Oh, he was so good in it.
Yeah, he was good. He seems like to not have aged a day in all the time, and he was really good. He was very funny when he came into the editing room to check out the cuts, and you know, there was two interesting conversations. One was he had a suggestion. He said, you know that cut of me? Wouldn't it be good if it was two cuts of me and you could put something in between? So,
I
thought it was very good. Actor giving, and of course they were close-ups. So,
were they close-ups of his butt? Was it like the butt shot?
Well, that's the other thing was that he asked. So, has there been any problems with my performance? And we had been submitting to the MPAA, and indeed they had no problem with the violence, which really surprised us. But they had a little bit of problem with the nude shot of his butt. So I said something about, well, I think, you know, your hairy ass may be scaring people. And he got very, very quiet. About a half hour later, he said, so you think my ass is really a problem?
Oh, man.
I don't know if we...
That's weird that they would say that about a guy. It's like a chick can just be, like, buck naked and, like, whatever, it's fine. You see, like, a man's bum and it's some big deal.
Yes. Well, vanity doesn't exist in just one sex.
That's true. It's funny because, to me, Very Bad Things is almost like the original Hangover, like a dark version of the Hangover. Have you heard that?
Well, I was suggested for the Hangover, and I said, well, this will never work. I've already done this movie, and I can tell you it won't make a dime.
Wow, you kind of knew. You're like, no, this is the original movie,
like,
the best.
Well, you know, but it goes to show you that movies in general are about timing. When you put out a movie, you could put out the same movie in two different years and it would have a complete different response to the audience. And that's an indication. I think, you know, in a way, Very Bad Things is even darker, and because, you know, Pete was willing to go all the way on that. But than the Hangover, that is. But I just think if you transpose the years, it would have still, you know, they were ready for that kind of movie. Yeah.
I love how no one's safe, and you never know who's going to go next. And then the only thing that makes it out alive in the end is the dog.
Yeah, with the three-legged dog.
The three-legged dog, and that's the dog that never had a problem, and that was, you know.
Yeah, well, and it ends with a...
It's a reckoning, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's crazy. It's crazy. Ends with Cameron Diaz running out of the house screaming, because this is now your suburban hell.
That big shot where it's like a big jib shot and she's just in the middle of the street. And
yeah.
Looking bad for like once in her life. Maybe
yeah.
The only time ever.
I'd like to tell you one thing, one more thing on that is that the editing-wise, The most complicated sequence is actually where the stripper gets skewered on the thing, because it's a cross-cut sequence between the activities in the bathroom and the joy of the party going on, and trying to get it to have an escalation and then a peak and then sort of a downbeat so he comes out. So that was a challenging one, because they're not written that way. They don't say in the writing, you're going to cut here, we're going to do this, then you're going to cut, then cut back. They just sort of generally say, this is happening and this is happening. And then it's the editor's job to find a way to fold them in.
To tell that part of the story with a little bit of tension, to make everybody wonder what exactly happened, what is he going to do?
Yeah, and the whole idea is it has to be the most fun anybody could ever have till it's no longer fun anymore. So there you have it.
I like that. Is it on Very Bad Things that you first kind of clicked with Jon Favreau?
Yeah, that's where we met, and he came in. I remember I met him when we were re-recording his dialogue, and he was, you know, he had done Swingers already, and so he was, you know, both being an actor, he was really hot as a writer and looking to direct. And then he contacted me a few times after, once to do a pilot that didn't work out, but eventually we did connect. And he had thought that Very Bad Things was such dark material that some people just say there is nothing redeeming, but the people who do find it funny, sick people like you.
I'm sick. I love it.
He thought that, well, if you could do that, then you can handle this. And so he drafted me first to do A Polish on Maid, which was sort of a tryout for him and Vince, which are similar. Everyone thinks they're the same camp, but they're not. They're two different camps. But then afterwards, on to Elf.
Yeah, Elf. Oh, my goodness.
Canadian shot. That's why
yay,
it's so good.
Yay, Canadian swing. Actually, I have a really big question about Elf. So Will Ferrell's known for his improv ad-lib craziness. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you had to deal with as an editor on that? Or deal with? I mean, I'm sure it was fun, but...
Yeah, I had to deal with it.
Yeah, you had to deal with his humor just coming out at you, unexpected.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, Will actually is, even as broad as that movie is, he's actually a broader guy, and he was under a bit of constraint, which was quite controversial while we were making it. Because he had done Old School, and there was a whole vibe that just let him go and let him go all the way. But John felt, and then in post we felt together, that you had to keep the heart in it, so you couldn't let anything devolve beyond this character's aspirations, and to keep the heart in it.
Like an innocent humor, yeah. Nothing too intense.
And, you know, one of my principal things on that movie was that there was a layer of cynicism that I actually stripped out right away. And I realized it wanted to play younger. And that was controversial while we were making it. To the point where, you know, there was definitely people who thought we were really blowing it. And it was very tense for a while. And I remember I have a sister who lives in England, and she was asking me, what's happening? Well, I'm going through this and this, and people think I'm not doing this thing right. She says, well, what are you working on? Oh, a Christmas movie for kids.
No one would think yeah. That would be stressful.
No, it can be. Especially, you know, you're making these movies, it's in July, and you're listening to Christmas songs all day.
But I guess what people maybe don't think about first is it's sensitive content because of the target market, so you have to still make it funny, still make the parents want to see it, but also
well, that film also was a kind of a personal miracle for both me and Favreau. I had had it happen early in my career when I was in music videos, but that was the first all-out hit film that I worked on. And the interesting thing about a hit film is that if it smells like it could be a hit, they won't give it to you unless you've done a hit before. So mm-hmm. It's a catch-22. The only way to get to work on hit films is to have made a hit film. But if they think it could be a hit film, forget it. So what you have to do is get it on a film that's supposed to be some little thing and have it
go... It's like a sleeper.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It has to go big.
Yeah.
And so that film did, and it was an amazing moment out of our, you know, all this angst of, you know, the people who said we're making it too young and making it wrong. We were actually put in front of the preview process. Well, John was, it was only his second film as a director, and he came into the office, and I had already done, you know, 10, 11, 12 films by then, and he said, it's great, we're going to have two previews the same day. And I said, well, but what does your contract say? Doesn't it just say you get two previews?
In total?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he said, oh, that seems like they want to throw us out. But what happened, I'm being very frank here.
No, you be Dan.
Yeah,
but you can be Frank just for a minute. Okay.
So what happened is we put it in front of this audience, and they started off. The early audience was kids with their families, right? And they just loved it. They just loved it. They put it in front, and they were so happy to be watching this movie. And that was such the rewarding moment. The first time you put it in front of an audience to have them feel that way, and it was so great. And I remember I went afterwards to use the restroom, and I'm coming out, and their Studio Evil producer is on the side on the phone going, if you let kids out of the house, they'll like it. Don't worry about it. It's like some really bad cartoon, you know. And I'm like, oh, my God. So we go in, and you know, we go in, and all the executives are crowded around on the side, and they're all whispering a little excitedly. And it's like, oh, okay. And then I look at the line for the evening show. And it looks like we're going to a Metallica concert. There's guys with rings in their noses and tattoos. It's like, this isn't the audience for Elf. What's going on? Are they stacking the deck against us? But then the part two of the miracle happened. We put it on, and they roared. It was as big as the early audience was. This audience was just three times as loud, just laughing and roaring. And it was crazy. And so it was like, I remember, leaving that, and then all the executives are lined up on the side, and I go to the creative exec. I walk up to him and he goes, good job, really good job. And I go, yeah, well, seemed like, you know, you guys might have been a little unhappy and wanted to see a change. And he goes, yeah. That's my Elf story.
Oh, man. We got the delinquent teenager vote. This is good to go.
Well, then they call those movies a four-quadrant movie, meaning that all the age groups and demographics want it. So then the head of the studio at the time, we have our meeting afterwards, and the cartoon evil guy was like, this must be a mistake. We should put it in front of another audience right away. And he goes, I know a hit when I see one. Of course, he didn't know it a week before, but he knew it then.
Well, that's awesome. That's a good success story.
It's my Elf story.
You knew the whole time, though. You knew the whole time. So Elf was done in the mid-2000s. So is that when the editing techniques were changing at all? Is that around the time?
Sure. I mean, the editing techniques had been changing already. Even on the get-go of my career, by the second movie I did, I was cutting on Avids, but we had, at that time, parallel film rooms. So I would be cutting electronically, and I would have assistants in another room cutting the print to keep up with me so that when we went to preview, we could throw up a print. And so that was a very stressful job for them, because if the splice broke during the preview, or you know, or if you could see them, because we used something called Inviso splices, which were very fragile, you know, would ruin the experience. So, you know, the assistants universally hate previews, especially back then. But now the technology has changed, and we do the entire thing in the computer.
So back then it was kind of like double effort. For sure, to get anything screened,
I mean, there
or to
was,
go ahead with a version of a cut?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, comedies preview a lot more than other kinds of films. So I've even had a comedy preview 14 times. And because what you're trying to do is you're trying to hone in the laughs. Maybe there's some overall structural problem, but then you're trying to get it, you know, pinpoint on, and then there's a debate. You know, healthy debate outside of what is accurate. So you use audiences, you know, to tell you. It's very unscientific, though, because different audiences might react differently, but generally you can see what's hitting and what isn't.
I think comedy is the hardest thing to create for
any
type of storyteller, whether it be a writer or an editor, because I believe editors are storytellers as well.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
No, it is. It is comedy. You have the onus of both telling a story and being funny. So it's a double whammy.
Well, you seem to have a little bit of humor. I can kind of tell already. So maybe I think that probably comes easy for you. On the lighter side, I was very impressed with Zathura. Is that how you say it?
Yeah. Well, see, that's pretty good. That was a movie Zathura! That people couldn't pronounce very well. Sometimes we called it Zafira
in the editing room. Don't lift your hand too high when you say that.
No, but it was.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, no one can pronounce that movie.
All right, well, I did a good job. It looked awesome.
Well, our joke afterwards, because it got very good critical reviews. In fact, the best of those ones. But, you know, not a whole lot of box office. And John Favreau, the director, his joke was always the person in line goes to buy the ticket and he says, I'll see Chicken Little. Because that came out the same week.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Jumanji was just as hard to say, and I mean, it's kind of along the same lines.
J's are easier than Z's.
That's for sure. That's for sure. No, it looked really, really well done, and the VFX were great. And
yeah, that was my first huge foray into VFX.
And there's practical practical effects, and then there's also like CG and everything in there.
Yeah, so. It's a total mixture, because there was even a huge miniature shoot, which was as long as the principal photography shoot. It took that long. And what was really cool was that I would be sitting, they have these guys called pre-visualization guys, and they basically now do things in computers. But what we'd do is that he'd hand me things, I would cut them, and I'd say, no, let's have the house go here, or there, or this way. And then he would manipulate it in his computer, and then they would send it straight to the miniature set. Into that computer would take his, and then they would shoot the stuff. So it was crazy. It was
combination
great.
Of everything.
Yeah.
And Kristen Stewart.
Young Kristen Stewart. Yes.
Back when she was okay with making facial gestures.
Yes. Well, Jesus. And I'll tell you the inappropriate
you don't
story
have to agree
here.
With me.
I'll tell you the no.
But
she
you're
was,
cooler if you knew.
I'll tell you, she was brilliant. And well, first of all, Favreau had said I have to have a real actor for this, so there was a big search, and more they wanted to give us a Nickelodeon actress. But he had known her from Panic Room, and so she came in and did this table read and this long table. I'm part of that too. So it was she was great. The most interesting thing was when she freezes in the movie, they had to make a life-size frozen version of her. And it was in her contract that after this was over that they had to get that because they didn't want any inappropriate things happening to this frozen version of Kristen. Even then.
Well, I saw it. It actually looks exactly like her. They did an amazing job, so I can see maybe...
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, maybe they rented that out for other movies, like
yeah
or they well, were, and that was like maybe that's the big secret. You heard it here. That's the big secret.
Big secret.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And then, and the dude from Hunger Games, is that the little kid?
Yeah, no. That
I was like, I think that's him.
Well, that and the two boys. The
older of the
older
kids.
The older of the oh gosh, that's
the Hunger Games guy.
Ah, yeah, he just escapes me, and the other one. The younger one was Jonah Bobo, who was just in that great comedy with Steve Carell, where names are escaping me right
no
now.
Worries.
Yeah. Anyway.
So yeah, that's cool. That's cool
Got
to see them.
Cut here.
Crazy Stupid Love.
Crazy Stupid Love. Yeah. So Jonah Bobo grew up and he was taken out of the business and just reemerged in Crazy Stupid Love, which is wonderful. And those kids were great. Yeah.
Yeah. Even though I'm an adult, I still love those kind of kids movies. I'm not afraid to say it.
You're oppressed.
Yeah, probably. Probably. Oh, geez, he knows. So continue along with, I feel like you and Jon Favreau are like BFFs for sure. Just still. Oh, what?
No, you're good. Keep going. Computer.
Okay.
Computer. Oh.
Oh, yeah, we're going to get you to edit something.
Oh, it probably died.
All right, okay.
Screw it.
Okay. We'll comp in just like an image of Jon Favreau with like his thumb up. Like, yeah, these people are awesome. No, just because I see that you've collaborated a lot.
He's kept me busy for the last decade or so. And, we're more like an old married couple than BFFs, really. We bicker.
So not friends.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Like, but you just know each other that well that it makes sense to keep collaborating.
Yeah, because what it becomes is that you find somebody that shares your sensibilities and that you can stand to be in a room with for 6-8 months or longer and can get the job done. And it's actually, editing is a very hard position to fill. I've talked to so many directors who, it's such the personal position because directors are also very worried because they feel very naked in front of the editor because you see all the stuff that they did, good or bad, and you know, whereas the general public's just going to see an edited product.
The best of the best, yeah, from the director.
Like there's nothing they do that isn't great, and so there's a big trust in this. Yeah,
definitely. Well, you've proven yourself. You went on to do Cowboys and Aliens as well, which I loved. Mm-hmm. That was awesome.
Thank you.
Do you have any fun stories about working on that film?
Yeah, well, it was, you know, we were out in New Mexico, outside Santa Fe, and it was fun. I got to be in this little group that rode motorcycles around New Mexico, including Harrison Ford.
Oh, was that in your job description?
Well, you know, somebody had to do it.
So, like, Harrison's bored. Just
yeah, it's
go,
like, here's...
Go hang out with him. Pretend he's amusing. Just go.
I just worked with Peter Rosenfeld. Who was
yeah,
talking about the most?
He was. That was our, yeah, that was our little club. It was.
You guys had a biker club out in New Mexico.
We did, and actually, Peter was the leader. Yeah, he's a camera operator.
Oh,
yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah, so we were riding around New Mexico, and Harrison and Keith Carradine was there with his lovely wife, and it was, we were a tough gang, you know. They were on their BMW motorcycles, and,
nice.
You know, yeah,
like cowboys of present day,
yeah,
on horses, but still with horsepower.
Yeah, but that one also, that movie, what was really cool for me was spending 2 weeks with Steven Spielberg. So he was in the editing room with us, and it was fun and very challenging because he had brilliant ideas, but it was one, you know, a lot of it was once he understood what we were trying to do, then his ideas would be just precision, pinpoint on. And part of my mission was to really be on my game, so you know, they would be half done with the sentence and I would be doing the edits so that we never ended the conversation. So it was great, it was so wonderful, but at the end of every day I was just exhausted because you know, I just wanted it to just keep being fresh, and it was fun.
Lots of feedback, lots of working around it.
Yeah, and then he and Favreau sitting on the couch playing ukuleles while I was cutting away. Yeah, that's fun.
Oh, man, I would like to see that. So, I saw one of your past interviews, and you described something called Death Row. do you still have inmates in Death Row, and tell us what that means?
Okay, well, there's two Death Rows in my career. One when I worked for Death Row Records is in my music video days,
oh,
and,
okay,
and did all of the Snoop Dogg and all those guys, but that was then. But Death Row, okay, What Death Row is that we put a representative card for every scene in a movie up on the wall. And that way we can visually look and shift scenes. And what would happen if we move this scene here? What would happen?
But so it would change the story as you go through.
Well,
and
this way you don't have to make the edits to kind of understand what some of the ramifications are. Because people, yeah, I got a perfect idea. This happens here. Oh, well, that's great. That character hasn't even been born yet, so it doesn't work. So if you put it up there, you kind of remember. But the card, the scenes that get cut out of the movie go on the bottom to a row called Death Row. And then, you know, later if the director wants to be a liberal, they can pardon a scene and put a part of it back in the movie. But yeah, you're always told, any editor who you interview here will tell you that every movie they ever do from the studio's perspective is 10 minutes too long. Doesn't matter how long it is. It could be 4 hours, it could be 20 minutes, it's 10 minutes too long. So they'll always give you that note. So then you go, well, I'm going to cut this scene, put that on Death Row, and then they'll go, you can't cut that scene. Well, what do you want me to cut then?
25 to life. Yeah. And a Death Row.
Yeah. Certain scenes do deserve a reprieve here and there, but...
Are there any scenes that made it to Death Row that, you know... eventually didn't get back in to the edit that you still wonder to this day if that would have changed anything? Or?
Well, I often think that part of the reason Favreau hired me because he was so mad that in Very Bad Things I cut out his great monologue at the end of the movie. And it was because no one wanted to see it. They just wanted the movie to end. It was traumatic enough. So he had this wonderful, and he did a wonderful job. It was this speech, how in life nothing works out. And it was great. And he used this example of from Pete Berg's own father's story of inventing a dog food called Pupcorn that their dog rejected. And it was hilarious, but it just didn't belong in this part of this movie, so it had to go. And I think that in his, want for revenge, he hires me so then he can be cruel to me.
He has control over Death Row now.
He does have control. There will never be innocence put there again.
Nice. So I wanted to talk about... a dark movie called From Hell.
From Hell.
Hell.
Very hellish.
Now, I read that it's a screen adaptation of a graphic novel.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that attracted you to this project? Or
no.
No?
No, you know, it is. It is, and that's a very respected graphic novelist, or as I call them, comic book writers. But I'm sure that'll get me in a lot of trouble. The Hughes brothers are who I came up with, and they were doing that movie. And I had met them when they were 19-year-old, doing their first music videos. And their rise was a rocket launch, and they took me with them to the movies. And so... From Hell was, the last of those that I did with them, and it was Johnny Depp, and it was gorgeous movie, wonderfully lit, and it moved, but it was like another very strange experience working on a movie, because we had, let's just say there was a lot of absinthe floating around the cutting room, and... folks like Marilyn Manson hanging around, and it was a little bit crazy.
I think in one of the descriptions, they describe Johnny Depp's character as like a detective who's clouded by his absinthe addiction or whatever.
We had to understand that. You cannot edit properly. It's like method editing. It's method editing. You have to get in there.
Not like meth editing, though, right? No.
And so, yeah, they were flying in cases of this crazy stuff, and we were mixing. And it was definitely an interesting, very interesting working time. And, yeah, a Yeah.
So Marilyn Manson stops by because he hears you have absinthe and that you're working on a slasher film, which is always exciting.
Yeah, well, he ended up doing some music for it, too. At the end, there's this song. It's pretty cool. And, yeah, there was a lot of stuff going on during that one. It was very... It was quite strange times.
Did you have to reference the comic at all to make your cut?
They had in the images some of the, you know, beautiful frames, and I just know, you know, the Hughes brothers and Albert Hughes in particular are just visual geniuses. And you know, pretty much as good as I've ever worked with in making just, you know, frames that are like paintings. And so some of those were out of the comic book that were expanded, you know, greatly by what they were trying to do and you know, what the DP and the designer did. And one of the kind of interesting stuff, though, that I had to do were things like the dream sequences, where their description to me was that they wanted to feel related to... you know, the early pre-movie movies, you know, those experiments and the flicker things that people would, you know, Nickelodeons watch and stuff. And so I went down this very long rabbit hole into this and literally was chopping frames in here and just like, if you look at that thing frame by frame, it's scary. It's some scary images.
It's some like Frankenstein...
It is, but I mean, you know, he's the serial killer that kills women, and so, and it's like, there are frames in there that, you know, are very graphic. But
so it's a slasher film because you slash the film.
The funny thing is, I don't think of it even as a horror film. No. I think of it as a thriller. Mm. But it has imagery, some disturbing imagery. But the scariest thing is always the suspense that leads up to the... you know, up to it. But, you know, on a visual level, that was some of the best work that I've been associated with, yeah.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. I just love horror movies, so I have to bring them mm-hmm. up. That's my thing. Well, because I'm sick, remember?
You are.
Sick mind. Let's see here. So, Couples Retreat.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen it myself, mm-hmm. but it looks like a wild ride.
Well, Couples Retreat... interesting. Now we're off in a very different aesthetic here, which is a sort of a more mainstream middle America aesthetic of, you know, this kind of comedy. This is Vince Vaughn, one of my associations with him. You know, we indeed got to go to Bora Bora and to shoot that, so it was real tough. And I had to set up my editing room in one of these huts that are over the water. It was awful. It was awful. and you know how long it took me to snorkel to dailies every day?
Oh, terrible, man, terrible. You poor dear.
But that said, I felt bad for them because, you know, at least I could be inside the air conditioning. As beautiful as paradise is, they were out there sweating like madmen in the heat, you know, and I was like, you know. Going
just
on, but,
chilling
yeah.
in your studio.
Yeah, but then, you know, then we got back and there was, you know, back to being a regular movie, and that was the one that previewed 14 times. So it was like,
is that again because the whole comedy?
Well, you're trying to hone it. You want it to be better. You want to get it to a point because they have scores and numbers and how much the studio will then spend on marketing, all these things that audiences don't know about, how you're literally, with every movie you do, you're fighting to get everyone to be behind it because it's self-perpetuating that if they're behind it, then they're going to put more into marketing and all that, that they'll get all in. So we would do that, and that had another, actually a very... difficult cross-cut I had to do was to try to make the end resolves work. Because in that movie, you end up having... It's four couples, and so they each have to have their resolution. Mm. But, you know, an audience really isn't used to inform having four resolutions. They want one resolution. So then the solution again is, instead of having each one have this full, long thing, is to once again fold them in like a deck of cards and make it try to feel like one resolution. Mm. So I mean that's again the kind of thing that in editing that you have to you know pull a rabbit out of your hat a little bit to make that work. And I remember when I did it, it was like I said, it was like let me do this. And then people were like, no, you're ruining all these individual great moments. And I go, I know there's sacrifices. Let's do it and put it up in front of the audience and see what happens. And indeed, they really did enjoy it. The overall picture immensely more because of it.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, I guess they all have to have the same journey to some end. And I'm assuming, do they all end up happy again?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, in this kind of, yeah, in this
and
kind
they all
of thing,
have pretty, like, I looked into it a little bit. They all have pretty severe problems that they're at the end of their rope, literally.
Yeah.
And to come from that to a conclusion where everybody's happy again is...
Yeah. And you're talking genres, so, you know, these are forms. And people say they want you to break genre, and I've done all those pictures like Very Bad Things and these things that break genre. But when you're operating in genre, people want you... They want this kind of satisfaction of their expectations. So you have to, you know, find a way. And ensemble pieces are going to always be harder than following, you know, a character or two, you know.
Trying to give everybody equal screen time.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah. Cool. So let's talk about a couple pretty badass films, Iron Man and Iron Man 2. Perhaps you've heard of them. Again, Jon Favreau loves you to bits. Come on this journey with me. At what point did he bring you on?
Well, interesting on that one. Well, but by then we are, as you say, BFFs, I guess, right?
yeah. Bros, bromance.
Yeah, we're having our bromances.
There's
yeah.
dudes.
And... we were supposed to do, John Carter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, at that time, John wanted to do it, and it was at Paramount, and it was he had done all this work, and it was all set to go, and for whatever reasons that these things happen, it got canceled. And so, as the story goes, he, you know, they were dangling this thing to him, and he calls me, and he says, "Hey, come by." I come by and he says, "We're not going to do John Carter." I was like, "Oh, well, we're going to do Iron Man." I said, "Iron Man? So they're going to make a movie out of that Black Sabbath song, huh?" I had no clue.
And you were pumped because of your music video background.
Yeah, like, well, you know, I was like that Black Sabbath song. it's this Marvel comic, so we you know, that was quite the experience, because Marvel had been involved in movies, all these great movies, Spider-Man's, but they had never made a movie. This was their first movie.
Hmm.
And it was kind of an all-in situation, and there was a huge learning curve over there, and so we were, you know, I had to explain why there was a couch in my editing room and things like that.
Managing expectations from step one.
Yeah, I had to explain that I take naps. But
you know, I live here, right?
Yeah. yeah. So it was. Iron Man is so rewarding for me because it's so well. It's massively successful, but I also think it's really good. And it was really hard. It was a hard movie. The first cut was 3.5 hours long, and it you know, and it's all over. And Downey was so brilliant, but he was improvising a lot. And so in this form, you have to admire the guys that did Gibson and the Lethal Weapons, because when they do that, you have to then find a way to weave it to be a coherent thing, because it may have been one take over here, or it may have been this and that, but your whole gig is to look, this guy is giving you gold. Well, how are you actually going to be able to functionally use it? So there was a bit of that, and then there was hardcore structural issues to solve. A cave scene that in its first cut was 55 minutes long, that turned out it's 20, 25 in the movie. Yeah. So it's like, you know, but a lot of things happen, so how do you again squeeze that down into a usable piece? But it's great, you know, once, you know, we started going and it really looked like some of this was just marvelous. And then at a certain point, it starts to gel, you know, as we're fighting the stuff in post. And then we started to know, okay, this thing could be the one. Yeah, that was pretty cool.
I don't know anybody that doesn't love the films. Like, everybody just gets something out of it, I think. It's all
everyone,
ages,
everyone's
everybody.
Loved one that worked on the movie hates it. Only because you're gone your whole life, you know.
You just have working, no soul. You know?
No.
Giving
everyone,
up everything.
No, it really you know, it really was this great journey that had a huge payoff there. And, you know, personal high point for me was day it was released, I get a call on my cell phone as I'm driving, and I'm like, who is this? And it's the freaking head of the studio. I was like, hi! He's like, I just want to tell you this is the best film I've ever been associated with. And I was like, I guess it's all downhill from here.
Let me pull over right now before I crash my car. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah,
that's
so that
like
was
the
pretty...
highest tier compliment next to like Jesus. Like if Jesus
Yeah,
had
Jesus
called you, that might have been a little bit better.
Yeah.
Or the president. No, I think maybe Jesus.
I think he's on my prohibitive call list
though. You don't answer his call. <I can't. laughs> We won't put that in if you don't want to. But I think it's good. He's on my no list too. Within Iron Man and Iron Man 2, the shots that you see him and then him and Don Cheadle in their suits, and then the shots from the point of view of inside their helmet and looking at their faces, I find that was done really well because, you know, the whole thing is you've got these A-list actors, and if their face is covered for long periods of time during certain scenes, I feel like maybe motivation to keep having the shots of inside. You want to still make sure it's them.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the thing is that in looking at these things in the past, it became clear that the disconnect is once they get in their things and start flying around or swinging, whatever the superhero is, that you start to go, that's when, you know, the sophisticated audience starts to really wonder. So we're looking at it, and it was actually quite experimental. It wasn't, no one was sure it would work. And so they shot what they did, and it actually had to be shot a couple times because they didn't figure out how to shoot this, but they put a camera in front of Downey's face against a green screen on a swivel thing. So think him swiveling back and forth. And then realized that, well, you actually didn't need to do all that. Some of that could be done in effects, but some of the performances were so good, so to use them. But then I remember I had to sit with one of the effects team and figure out exactly what the interactions inside the helmet were going to be. And that was really interesting because now I look and they keep making them and Avengers and all this, and it's now convention. And it's really interesting when you do things before they were convention, but now they're convention. Because now everyone knows what this should be. But at the time, we were just experimenting to see, well, what could it be? And I would say that, and because people have been telling me the Marvel aesthetic these days, and it usually means this superhero mixed with humor thing. And I can assure you that did not exist going in, that was a mixture that we all settled on, that we all, and there were talks, believe it or not, there were very serious discussions in the middle of post-production whether to take out all the humor or not, because you don't do these in superhero movies. So believe it or not.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so you can see that the process of making a movie is this journey of discovery. And that those people who would sit in this chair and say that everyone knows what they're doing before and it just comes together is telling you a big, big, fat lie.
Do you think if it wasn't Robert Downey Jr. and his improvising, his like charismatic delivery of lines. Like, you think if it was a different actor, maybe they would have gotten their way.
You want that story, do you?
I don't know.
Well, I was there for the casting, too. And, you know, Mr. Downey had to do something that a person of his stature normally wouldn't have had to do, which was a screen test. Hmm. And he did it against a wonderful, young, sexy male actor who you know and probably find very alluring. And the guy did, they did the same scene, and the other guy was really good. He was really good, and he looked more like the comic book, and it was like, oh, okay, this is good. But Favreau is one of his most brilliant things is casting. And so he said, I know Downey's good. And the studio said there was too risky for the personal reasons and all this.
He's a wild man.
He's a wild man, and he could disintegrate. So anyway, I had the duty of putting these screen tests together. And so then Downey's screen test, he comes in, and oh my God, he was so good. He was dancing circles around. You know, you had the scene, but then there's always the scene within the scene, and he's just dancing around it, and it's just like you're just watching someone who's at a virtuoso level. So as the story goes, we brought it. I'm the only one who's seen it. We go into a theater to see it, and we're sitting with the current head of the studio, who wasn't by the time we got going, and who said that there's no way that they could hire this guy. And we looked at it, and he goes, that's our guy. And he goes, and I remember Favreau said, well, but what about the board of directors? You said that they wouldn't go for it. He goes, don't worry about the board of directors. He's fine.
So it was just kibosh, we're doing this.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's good to use this one. That could be trouble.
We'll just cross our fingers.
Yes.
We'll see what happens. We'll try to finish up so we don't sweat our butts off here.
Hopefully I'm not all...
No worries. Oh, right. Okay. So you've got a lot of heavy effects films under your belt. So say, for example, in Iron Man 2, the drone fight scene is like... I feel like it's all... I don't even know what's real in that
right.
scene. How do you put something in an assembly or an edit, knowing that you have to make quick decisions to get those shots to post and that kind of... I mean, I feel like a seasoned editor can do it best, but you probably had to learn the hard way how to please everybody and with the timing. How does that happen?
That drone fight sequence was actually cut by Rick Pearson because we cut Iron Man 2 together. I did Iron Man 1 on my own,
but
was finishing couples, so we did 2 together, and he did that, and he's a brilliant editor. And but when to answer the overall question is that... They shoot these background plates. First, they do these animatics. They have storyboards. They make them move. Then they actually make little animations to approximate what you're going to do. Then they send out crews and they shoot these background plates. And sometimes they have funny men who look like Teletubbies with things in their head running around to be stand-ins for where CGI effects are going to be. And on Cowboys and Aliens, we had deserts full of these guys running and hopping around, like, you know, it's like, and to be honest, we don't, a lot of this is, you know what's supposed to happen in the story, but what happens in reality is they get these plates and then we decide what we can do with them. So the plates being the background of what you see. So if Iron Man is flying here, you see this swish pan along the freeway. And then we're going to put him in and he's going to fly over there. But it's based on, we had to look and see exactly what we can do with what they gave us.
Do they, I guess in any situation that you're working on a film like this, do people really count on you for your input to make sure that what they're intending is actually going to work?
Look,
because I mean, they don't want to waste their money if they're going to do a shot that's not even going to work for you, right?
So. Well, yeah, it has to go through stages before it gets turned over, and it's a give and take because the effects guys are also on the set, and they're getting things, and they have a plan in their head, but then it has to go through the editing room. And then we have to go and pinpoint it before they start the really expensive work. And it all comes back, and so there has to be an agreement. Then we do turnovers. Then stuff starts coming back, and then we readjust. So it's kind of parking a boat. You're a little this way, no, a little this way, no. Well, this doesn't work, and you go through so many blind alleys that lead you nowhere, and you have to go back. And sometimes we've had things with hundreds of iterations before it got right. How the decision's ultimately made. Editors are a bit of a used car salesman, because you have to explain to people why this is the best way to do it, why this is the best cut, and why, you know, this is the way your $150 million film should be. And you have to do it with a straight face. It's the truth, because everyone, you know, no one really knows until, you know, it's too late to change anyway. So you have to get a scheme that you think is going to work, and you got to sell the heck out of it. Because there'll be talked back, and maybe you bring it to the director and they say no. And then say, okay. And then you let it sit. And then, you know, sometimes it's a time bomb. It's like, 2 weeks later, here it comes. We're going to do that, but we're not going to do what you said. We're going to do this. It's like, silly. That's how it works.
Well, you have to put, you have to stand behind what you know is right, because that's when you get calls from the head of the studio saying, hey, way to go. You did an amazing job. So.
Yeah, well, and some of it is less knowing and more suspecting that if you go down this, you're going to find the right way, because you're putting a puzzle together. And, you know, you've put puzzles together. What do? You start with the ends, right? And you start filling in the things that you can fill in. And the more you fill in, the more you can get. So what you're trying to do is narrow it down and put yourself in a position to succeed. That's quite different from being absolutely sure that something is going to work. It means you have faith in the process. And, you know, the shoot is only, you know, a third as long as post-production is. It's a very long process to find it and get it from here to there and to hone it, you know.
So what is next for Dan?
Well,
let's talk in third person for the rest of the interview.
Well, if I was Dan...
What would you do if you were Dan?
I'm about to do a pilot with Favreau starting on Monday. Strangely enough.
Bro, you're homie.
I know. It's crazy. And then there's a talk of a film right after that. But is it all right if I do a little plug on or just talk about it?
Yeah.
And also my interests have started to shift a bit, and have been interested in helping the process for all of us editors. So I set out to make my own nonlinear editing software, which is called TouchEdit, and it's on the iPad of all things, and it's pro because it can interact with the pro editing system. So my idea is that I would have, I have all of these responsibilities now, and so much more is being shot, and so much of my time is spent driving to the set or waiting for people, that I thought I'm gonna make it so we can edit wherever we are.
Amazing.
So, and then be able to send it from here back to our big behemoth editing systems and work with it that way.
Okay, well, we'll take a look at that on TechBytes.
TechBytes.
Which we will shoot in a bit.
I'll put on my bow tie for that one.
Oh my God, that's exciting. Well, thank you so much for coming out. The man who rode motorcycles with Harrison Ford,
yes,
and drank absinthe with Marilyn Manson and has a lot of secrets that...
And I haven't even told you about Snoop Dogg.
Oh, my God! Oh, my God. Okay, do we want to do that real quick? Or no? You can tell me offline.
This is a family show.
I'm sorry, just one second. How do you pronounce your last name properly?
Leventhal.
Okay. Dan Leventhal, picture editor. Thanks for coming out.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, now I'm going to do the intro.
Okay.
That was the outro,
yeah,
right? Okay. Welcome back to Craft Trek in the Cut. We're here with Dan Leventhal, picture editor. That was the easiest I've ever done that.